Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how did our ancestors deal with changes in climate and the environment? What does it tell us about our current situation? And first, how can we ride the emotional roller coaster of difficult times? Lily Ning talks with Martinus Becker about building emotional resilience.
How do we ride the emotional roller coaster of difficult times? I'm in conversation with Martinus Becker, a clinical psychologist and expert in dialectical behavioral therapy for young people. Welcome, Martinus.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Just from the outset, I want to acknowledge that these are challenging and uncertain times, and that people might feel quite distressed as we're talking about emotional states. So I would encourage people to call a crisis helpline or hospital-based mental health services if they feel distressed. Firstly, Martinus, can you explain what emotions are and why we have them?
I think emotions are awesome, all of them. Anger, sadness, anxiety, you know, they all helped us to act quickly, to shape our thoughts in the moment, our body's like physical responses, and ultimately that urges to act in a particular way. Essentially, they provide us with like a really quick automatic communication to us and other people around us. If we had to manually figure out our best reaction in any given situation, ranging from crossing the road or talking to a friend or family member, we'd be very slow and sometimes rather dangerous. So instead, we have these quick automatic experiences called emotions that guide us through life much more efficiently. I suppose the challenge comes that with any automatic system like that is it's going to have some inaccuracy when it does it that quickly. So at times we perceive danger when there is none, or the intensity of our emotions end up like paralyzing us instead of motivating us.
You've mentioned that emotions can be helpful, but they can be deeply unhelpful.
Every emotion has a function. Joy drives connection. Shame stops me acting against my community's values, or guilt stops me acting against my own values. Anger can motivate me. Anxiety prepares me, and so forth. So emotions become unhelpful when they no longer serve that function well, when the intensity or the type of emotion doesn't really match the situation, and they don't help us anymore. They don't help us kind of navigate through the world.
It's quite a difficult world to navigate through at the moment.
It is.
What are the benefits of being aware of our emotional state?
In DBT, one of the key skills that we teach is mindfulness. And, you know, mindfulness is utilized in lots of ways. One of the ways we use it is to heighten awareness. Because if we are aware of our emotions, of our thoughts, of our urges, of all those bits that go with emotion, then those automatic emotions that I was talking about earlier, like, it gives us a chance to do something different, to choose a different way of responding to them, a more effective way, a way that helps us move forward closer to our goals. So like that emotional awareness is absolutely key. Without it, we often feel like emotions just rolling away from us, a slave to them, or just kind of going with them without being able to actually do something when they pop up. So yeah, awareness is absolutely key, both in ourselves and other people as well.
I'm going to back up a little bit because you are an expert in dialectical behavioral therapy, which is DBT. Sure. And perhaps you can explain a little bit about what that entails, because it was Marsha Linehan who first developed the principles of DBT.
Marsha did this back in the 90s. DBT is something that I'm very passionate about, and I think for good reason. The first book on it was called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Borderline Personality Disorder. At its core, it is still CBT. Or like cognitive behavioral therapy. And CBT often is a way of understanding the world in terms of the thoughts and behaviors that keep us acting and feeling the way that we do in the moment. And it's often kind of practiced in getting a core set of skills, teaching people new skills, new ways of taking on their thoughts or their behaviors. And it wasn't working for a lot of people. It wasn't working for people with quite strong emotions in particular, strong emotions that led to them doing really ineffective things like harming themselves or leaning heavily on substances. And they were dropping out of therapy, or therapists are getting burnt out. So DBT came along and put a structure around CBT skills. That structure involves teaching skills for a group. So we always get our skills taught, no matter what crises are going on for people, as well as individual therapy too, to help understand where skills are necessary. Things like phone coaching to get skills to show up in the moment. Because ultimately, if we want to change the way things go forward, we have to have a new behavior show up in the moment where we most need it. And the whole structure of DBT is set up around that, including the team that I work in called a consult, who, yeah, work to keep each other well. So hence why DBT therapists, when you meet them, are often very passionate, because we live and breathe these skills. We use them ourselves. Once you kind of see the DBT way of life, it takes over a bit.
So you're opening up an emotional space for people to express what they're feeling, which also decreases their physiological arousal. And I just wondered if you could speak to the advantages of articulating what it is we are feeling.
Articulating how we're feeling is really beneficial. Before, when I was talking about emotion and its function, right, and where it's unhelpful when it no longer meets its function. Its function is to communicate to us and to other people. If I'm not able to articulate emotion effectively, it can get really confusing, because sometimes the way my face looks or my body responds, my body language, doesn't fit with how I actually feel. So I'm trying to portray something that's not going on for me. And it might actually come from me not understanding what I feel. A lot of people, when I ask them what's going on, will tell me I feel angry. And very rarely, when someone feels angry, is that the emotion that really underlies it. Because somewhere underneath it, they've lost something and they're feeling sad. Or somewhere in the future, something they're really worried about and they're anxious. Or, they've been blocked from something that's really important for them. So anger often shows up after that. And understanding that and being able to articulate that I'm sad that I have lost this and you've had a part in that, that's why I'm angry at you, helps so much to have us communicate with other people, but also for me to target my efforts towards my sadness rather than the anger, which is kind of a consequence of it.
There's a term used in psychiatry called alexithymia.
Yeah.
And that is literally no words to describe feeling.
Yeah.
And people then typically find it difficult to respond to rising stress until that distress is fully blown.
Yeah.
How do you counsel people who have difficulty even describing and identifying their feelings?
It really starts with understanding them first. I think when I do professional development, even for colleagues, people who work in mental health, and I pose the question of what are emotions, the most common answer I get is feelings. And if I then pose the opposite question of what are feelings, they say emotions. And I think it's something that sometimes we get this, like, we feel like we inherently understand it, but actually really understanding it, like, what is it? How does it work? What's the parts of it? It's something that we're not actively taught very often. In terms of counseling clients to be able to do that, it's understanding that model first. So explaining a model of emotion. How does this all fit together? Like, how does a trigger lead to a way of interpreting it through to then the sensations in my body and the urges to act in a particular way? And then being able to tune them into any aspect of that they may be able to pick up on. So looking for clues and, okay, well, right now you might not have the words, but scan your body and tell me what you feel. Is there something in your chest? Is there something in your muscles, in your head? Any sensation, doesn't have to make sense, just let me know. And then trying to fill out the rest of the model from there. So we can start anywhere in the model to then try get the rest of the model out there as well.
What about tuning into the emotional states of other people? Why might that be important?
Oh, yeah. So that function of emotion in terms of communicating to other people, right? If I see you react to something on this conversation, you give me a sudden, I'm going to be looking really closely or try to listen for what's happened there, right? Because your emotion communicates to me. And being aware of that in other people, being good at picking up other emotions, means I have a better chance of responding effectively, responding in a way that helps me, one, to help you or to kind of maintain or foster this relationship. It's a great point to doing this, is just letting people know that I get what they're saying. So we often run on this assumption that people know that I know how they feel. And actually, when we do this thing where we just tell them how they've let us know they feel, sometimes we find out that we got it just right and they go, oh yeah, you get it. And sometimes we don't get it right and they go, no, that's not how I feel. And we have this great opportunity to find out how they actually feel and what's going on there. Yeah, I think tuning into other people's emotional states, that it helps us just respond more effectively, more accurately. Sometimes, I don't know, a lot of people I work with, both clinicians and clients, they have this fear that they'll get it wrong. But getting it wrong gives us a chance to get more information, to actually find out what's actually going on. So it's, yeah, a good place to start.
It brings to mind some ideas about perspective taking and this concept of theory of mind, how we are held in the mind of another. Can you talk about skills that can help people navigate particularly strong emotions?
If we're talking about strong emotions, we have to start by kind of knowing that most emotions last 90 seconds. I think it was a neurophysiologist that kind of made that claim. Most people kind of fall off the chair and go, wait a second, let me tell you about a time where I had emotions that were way longer, way stronger than that. And I think a lot of that's because emotions are self-perpetuating. They kind of keep themselves going through the ways that we're thinking, the things that we do in response to them, whatever they may be. So for instance, if I act on an urge to share my joy with other people, people smile and tell me other stories and I keep feeling happy. So that joy gets perpetuated beyond the 90 seconds. So if I'm thinking about skills and keeping that in mind, in the first instance, I'm trying to just break that cycle. I'm trying to break the next thing I'm going to do to keep this emotion going. And in DBT, we often use things like TIP skills. Now, TIP skills is an acronym where T is for temperature. Temperature here being something that's actually called the dive reflex. Interesting thing. Mammals have this reflex where if we hold our breath and get down into really cold water, our whole physiological system calms down. So for dolphins, for instance, it makes perfect sense, right? Because they can hold their breath and just really chill as they go deep under. But we have the same reflex. So we can kind of hack things like that to like just dunk our water in some icy water, hold it there as long as we can, and get that same physiological calming to break that cycle of that physiology maintaining it. Or like just doing jumping jacks. So that's the iron tip, intense exercise, right? Doing them till you just can't anymore, burpees, whatever it may be. You try feeling really angry whilst you're just like absolutely exhausted and panting and actually doing some really important physiological work and countering some of those bits through to things like paced breathing and that kind of thing. Those simple skills there are things that just break that cycle. Now, one thing to really note here though is once we've knocked down that intensity of emotion, these are essentially ways of avoiding emotion, right? I'm putting something else in to break the cycle, not feel this way, not think about it. That's what all I ever do. Then I'll have to keep needing these skills. So, you know, I think thinking about ways that I can then like respond to that emotion once the intensity is knocked out of it, give me really helpful. One skill that I always come back to is acting opposite. You know, I think if I feel anxious, our urge is to avoid and escape. And if I avoid or escape a thing that isn't actually dangerous to me, then I keep being scared of it, even though it doesn't make sense. So acting opposite means I go do the thing. As long as it's logically safe to do, I go do the thing. And my anxiety comes down. And I feel sad, I want to isolate in my room, do the like stereotypical thing, draw the curtains, watch Netflix, eat some ice cream. The more I hold myself in that space, the longer I'm going to feel sad. And when I then act opposite to that, when I force myself out of the bedroom, get dressed, get out, see someone, or Zoom at the moment, give someone a call, go for a walk around the block, whatever it may be, act opposite to that urge that comes from my sadness starts to shift. So I think first instance, if the emotion's just so strong, break the cycle, do something intense, temperature, exercise, whatever it may be, and then start thinking about how does this emotion actually shift long term.
There are some emotions that people feel which are overwhelming, so strong and intense,
yep,
that leads them to those urges to harm themselves, yep, in quite destructive ways.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how to counter those urges?
We often think about those urges that come up to harm ourselves as problem solving. Someone's in a position where they feel so overwhelmed, so awful, and of course their brain is going to come up with ways of feeling different. And when they come up stumped, then things like harming themselves or ending their lives come up as an option. It comes up in their head and they go, oh yeah, this makes sense because I haven't got something else. Coming up with other options to knock down the intensity of emotion. And that comes back to actually those skills that we were just talking about then. It's actually not any different there. It's about doing something else to knock that the intensity of emotion down long enough for me to ride out that urge that is driving me to want to hurt myself or end my life. Now, I know that seems really simple. And again, if that's all we ever do, then we get stuck in that cycle and we often end up feeling like that more frequently. And in the moment when those urges are really strong, dunk your head in a bucket of ice. You know, watch the funniest movie that you can. Watch the scariest movie that you can. Try feel really sad when you're watching just like a really terrifying movie. Change your emotion in some way. Reach out to people around you. A limit to that becomes people going, well, I don't want to share all my issues with them. I don't want to tell them about my things. You don't have to. You can have a chat about The Widow or the latest Netflix show, something to distract you or create a different emotion to get through that moment. And once you got through it, then start thinking about how that emotion can change longer term. And that's where therapists come into it, right? Get some help. Go ask your GP or someone that can actually direct you in the right direction and how that can be different. So in the moment, get through it in any way possible to put that behavior as far away from you as can, and then finding ways to change that emotion more longer term that brought that up.
It sounds a bit like a crash course in emotional survival. One of the things that I'm thinking about is you can't make things better straight away, and you can't necessarily make someone's life feel like it's worth living. So these difficult emotions that persist and where people actually have to dwell in them, that could be extremely difficult.
Absolutely. And I love that term that you used there of a life worth living. It's a very DBT term, because when we think about DBT and the ultimate goal for us, it's a life worth living. And the journey towards that's a long one. Often the young people that come to us, it's not like they started feeling sad a month ago. They often have histories of years, multiple different therapists they've tried or things that they've given a go, years of struggling. And it's taken years to develop those habits, and it takes time to come up with new ones. So in DBT, we do a full year with people to break through that. So it does take time, and a life worth living becomes a lifelong goal, something that I keep striving for, that I keep striving for personally, but definitely my clients as well. And DBT's aim isn't necessarily to attain that, because when do I decide that, okay, I've got it now? It's to set a trajectory towards that.
I've heard you talk about radical acceptance. Can you explain what that is?
In our world, there are some things we can change. There are challenges that are within our grasp. Like, I can solve lots of problems, like where I'm going to work or what I'm going to eat this afternoon or whatever it may be. I can solve quite complex problems. And then there are things that I don't have control over. You know, things like this COVID-19 thing at the moment, I don't have control over it. I can't tell the government what to do. I have these sanctions. I have these things that are imposed on me. I have the realities of the virus and what it's doing in the world. And I can't change that. So I can choose to battle that. I can choose to just go, it's just not fair. Like, why do we have to deal with this? I don't like this. Is this even true? Is this a conspiracy? And the more I do that, the more I kind of battle this idea, the more that causes my emotional distress, adds to it, right? On top of what makes sense, given the restrictions and the challenges that come with it. So radical acceptance is my ability to then accept it, to go, oh, this sucks. I'm stuck in my house. I haven't had a hug in a long time. I really, really just want some Thai food from down the road. I hate cooking every night. I'm really worried about my family overseas. And this sucks and I can't change it. Now, the bit that makes it radical rather than just acceptance is the behavior that comes with it. So I can accept something and then not do anything about it. But radical acceptance means that I act as if I've accepted it. I act on the next thing that I'm going to do, given I've now accepted it. Instead of getting caught up in my house and stuck on my couch, I get my dog out and I go, Ralphie, we're going for a walk. I pick up the phone. Oh, I would so much rather see this person in face to face. And I'm going to do the phone call anyway. The radical bit is where my actions match my intention of acceptance. And it's a super powerful thing. It's an amazing thing when we feel really stuck in where we're at.
So that's saying yes to life just as it is.
Yeah. And all its glory and gore. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about emotional resilience?
Yeah.
I think the word comes from the Latin resiliere, to leap or spring back. And it implies an ability to bounce back from life's stressful events.
There's plenty of factors that are part of resilience, right? Some out of our control, like the big stresses we were just talking about, things like our genetics or our history, the things we can't go back and change. But these are often referred to as kind of risk factors, the factors that make it more likely that we might have difficulties. And there are many more factors that are protective factors, resilience factors, things that can help us move forward. And it starts really simple. These are the basics. If we get right down to getting enough sleep, usually around 8 to 9 hours, depending on where you're at, and it can change for young people or adults. Eating balanced and regularly. My body needs food. And my brain needs food to cope with emotions and to cope with stresses that comes up. To move, our body has this natural reset in movement. When we engage in exercise, we burn through things like cortisols or stress hormones, and we create positive ones like endorphins. So in terms of emotional resilience, it actually starts that simple. Sleeping, eating, moving. Focusing on connections. Establishing new connections with people. Fostering existing ones. Rekindling old ones. Even ending harmful ones, to have those connections with people in our lives that can help us get through moments, to enjoy the joys and celebrations in our lives, but also get us through the sadness and challenges in our lives. So those connections become a key part to being resilient. And when we look at the literature around people who are resilient, it's right in there. Beyond all this is developing more flexibility. And this gets a little bit more intricate because it's in more flexibility in how we see the world. The D in DBT is dialectical. And dialectical, in essence, is our ability to see the world in a more flexible way, to see things how I see them and see another side. And when I can see at least two sides to every situation, it gives me more options of responding to the challenges life is going to throw at me. And the better we are at that cognitive flexibility, that ability to see the world in like multiple ways, the more effective we become at rolling with the challenges that come at us. Because it doesn't always just challenge our immediate way of seeing the world. We can see it in another way, a more effective way as well.
Some quite fundamental building blocks of resilience. So it's knowing when and how to express emotions and learning from setbacks and being able to take a stretched perspective.
Yeah.
How effective do you think all these things are in terms of buffering the effects of negative life events?
Critical. Negative life events are going to have an effect on us, right? That's normal. We talked about that function of emotion, right? And when challenges come up, I want to feel sad. I want to feel anxious. And I don't want those emotions to be so big that they don't help me. If I'm thinking about, and I think anyone listening, if they're thinking about, skipping a few meals and getting hangry, or they know that person who's particularly sensitive to that, emotions are just stronger when I'm hungry, right? That night where I got super disrupted sleep for whatever reason it may be. And at the moment, people are really struggling with that, right? Because routine's out the window. That next day, I'm just a bit snappier. My emotions are bigger. So my emotions have a much higher chance of being ineffective, of being out of proportion to the situation, not helping me. So those simple factors, those things like sleeping and eating and like moving, venting to people, they are so important and they have that like absolute impact on how we cope with the things that happen in our day. Doesn't mean we're not going to feel sad about it. I wouldn't actually want that, but it might mean that my intensity is closer to being effective for me.
It has been quite an emotional roller coaster over this lockdown period and in the weeks preceding it. Just wondered if you wanted to talk about anything relating to the roller coaster as you see it from a DBT perspective.
What has really stood out for me is how it has looked different for different people. I have friends who love it. I talked to a colleague earlier this morning who were like, this has been really good. I'm spending more time at home, less time commuting. I'm still getting all my work done, but actually there's more positive things in my life. And then people who are really struggling with it, where actually routines and sleep and social connection are just dropping out of their lives, where they perhaps live alone and they're forced into a bubble of one for a long period of time. So the emotional rollercoaster has had this shared global aspect to it, where everyone's to some degree experiencing this anxiety about this unknown of the situation we're in, or, you know, how's this going to look? How's it going to end? Are we going to find a vaccine soon? When will next stage happen? There's this global element to it. And then there's these individual experiences. And one thing that stood out to me is how much people are comparing their experience to someone else's. When our personal experience makes sense given our context, and I don't really need to necessarily have an experience that someone else is having because my context is different, even though there's this shared element to it. Reflecting on the kind of the roller coaster of all of this, I think everyone's on their own roller coaster, despite there being some common elements.
Yes, and I'm reminded that these times have mindful and heartful aspects, because every interaction we have has an emotional effect, and being able to notice and reflect on those as part of our growth. Thank you, Martinus, for helping me explore this question about how we ride this emotional roller coaster at this time. Thank you, Martinus, for joining me, and thank you to our audience for listening.
When we come back, our ancestors also faced environmental and climatic changes. How did they deal with them? What can we learn from our deep past? Stay with us. And this is poetry from the epicenter of quarantine. Alex and Fum reading a poem.
Enforce meditation. Bring it back. My ears wander outward, searching for sounds of life. There are no loud motorcycles hurling down my street, raging with testosterone. No dogs barking at the scent of another dog. The birds are not even chirping. Do they know? Bring it back. My eyes wander behind closed lids, searching for new images of life. other than the same rows of apartments, the vacant spots where cars used to park bumper to bumper for prime real estate. Crows are absent from my trees, abandoning me. Bring it back. The watcher within me whispers, "You've been here before. There is no difference." "It's not the same," I tell it. "I'm struggling. Shouldn't it be easier now that the world is silent? Shouldn't I find solace in the city's closed mouth? Instead, I ache. There's a pressure in my chest, a weight of ghosts dredged up by images of patients decked out with loops of plastic tubing and the familiar blue tube taped to their faces as it thrusts itself down their throat, piercing their lungs, breathing for them. This is what doctors do to help people survive, what they did to me so I could survive. Bring it back. My body strains to leave my meditation behind like an unfinished poem, to forsake the memories and feelings that have awakened. Where can I go without bringing them back? I sit, quarantine myself from running away. I feel, allowing tears to rappel down my cheeks. Eventually, the silence outside equals the silence within.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How have our ancestors dealt with earlier changes in their climate and environment, and what does it tell us about our current situation? With us is Simon Holdaway. He is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Simon Holdaway. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You've got three primary areas that you've been digging, essentially. Egypt, Australia, New Zealand. Are there reasons why you've chosen these three that seem like they would be disparate? Or is there some common theme that you're looking for?
It's a really interesting question, because if you look at archaeologists worldwide, they often really specialize in one area, certainly a temporal area, that's a time period, but often a geographic one too. So people will look at, for instance, the Yucatan area, the Mayan people, and at complex civilizations, so recent times. Other people are really interested in hominin ancestors, right? So the Paleolithic. So I guess I'm a little bit unusual because I've moved around the world and looked at people from different geographic areas, as you say, Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt. And I guess the reason is that I'm really interested in certainly the history of the peoples that I study, but I'm also interested in a comparative perspective to try and understand human cultural evolution on the bigger world stage, really, I guess, to do a lot of comparative work, to realize there's a lot of variation in the histories of different peoples around the world.
Well, good. That's exactly where I wanted you to go. So thank you for going there already. What are the comparison contrasts that you can draw from these three very old people, really? The big major differences that you find, as well as the common ground that you're finding.
The similarities. I think it's a little bit of a comment on our way of understanding human past in general. If we look at really coming out of the later 19th century, is this notion that people moved through kind of stages. So we had a hunter-gatherer stage, so people who hunted wild animals and used wild plants, right? And then there was the what people have described as a revolution, the Neolithic revolution, a sudden change with the arrival of domesticates. And then there's another later evolution, the urban evolution, as people start to concentrate into nucleated settlements, what we call villages or towns. And that's an idea that's been around for quite a long time. It really dominates still many of the textbooks in archaeology. But a number of us over the years, a number of colleagues really have started to dismantle, I guess, this notion of sudden and uniform changes. And I really emphasize this uniform notion that all peoples around the world somehow went through this series of stages from one to the other. And it's kind of linked to this notion of progression. So in other words, people who were hunter-gatherers had not yet progressed up to the level of the Neolithic, the term that we use to describe people with domesticated plants and animals. So much of my interest really is to take apart this notion of a fixed progression, indeed to take apart the notion of regression at all, and to understand the variability that there is in the way that people, humans in the past, have interacted both with themselves and with the environments they live in.
And so if we were going to take these three primary places where you've been doing your work, what would you say the differences were in those three? Australia, New Zealand, and Egypt.
I guess sort of intellectually what I've done is to start off in Australia, because I worked for a time at La Trobe University in Melbourne before I moved to Auckland. And my work in Australia was looking at relatively recent Aboriginal people, so the archaeology of relatively recent people last 6,000 years or so, because Australia has a long, long history of human involvement. And I was really, really interested in trying to understand the use of space, so how people distributed themselves across the landscape. And Aboriginal people made use of wild resources. They were, I guess, hunter-gatherers. They didn't have domestic plants and animals. They had the dog, but no other domesticated plants and animals. So they had a particular, I guess, life way. They moved a lot. And we were very, very interested in how people moved across the landscape, trying to get rid of this notion, I guess, that all of existence revolved around a place. And the analogy I use, I guess, is that we go from place to place. So we go from home to work, right? And our interest is in living in our house, our home, and then we get in some vehicle often and we drive frantically, or I cycle frantically to work, and then I'm at work. And so that passage from home to work is something that we kind of do as rapidly and as easily as possible. We don't think about it as a major part of our day. Our major parts of our day are at, if you like, nodes, places in the landscape. And what we've discovered, I really researched a whole lot in Australia, is that perhaps aspects of Aboriginal people's life was not like that. Much of life occurred during the journey rather than necessarily at the place. Certainly the sort of places that we find archaeological materials preserved. So we kind of changed this notion of node to node to think about movement as part of life, that moving through country was very important. And the Egypt project was interesting because we took whole series of different approaches, different methods that we developed in Australia, and we applied them in Egypt. And the interesting part about Egypt is that we had certainly a record of hunter-gatherers initially. The chronology is a little bit longer, and the material that I've looked at goes back to about 10,000 years ago through to about 6,000 years ago. But at the kind of end of that period, the people that we're studying, the remains of the people that we're studying, they adopted some domesticated plants and animals from Southwest Asia. So sheep, goat, a little bit of pig, wheat and barley. And what we did is to, I guess, use a different approach. People had seen the arrival of those domesticates as very much an important development, one of those kind of revolutions that I talked about before. And we approached it slightly differently, and we said, well, that's interesting, but I wonder if we put an Australian kind of perspective onto Egypt and look more at the level of movement around the landscape. Can we detect that? And we've got some techniques that let us look at that.
We'll just stop right there, because I'd like to know about the techniques. What are the techniques?
Well, the techniques make use of material that we find archaeologically. And we need to remember that archaeological material is the material that survives. So archaeologists look at a lot of quite unusual things. They look kind of other people's rubbish, but particular forms of rubbish, the rubbish that tends to survive. It's made out of materials that survive. So I spend a lot of time, for instance, looking at stone artifacts along with my colleagues. And stone's a kind of wonderful medium because people used it. In a world without metals, for instance, without plastic, you need something to cut things up and to scrape things and to manipulate other materials. And stone's a great medium for doing that. And it was very, very important for people for a very long time. But for archaeology, I guess the fantastic thing is not only was it important for people in the past, but it also survives. Reasonably difficult to destroy stone material, often survives in archaeological materials. The other great thing for us about stone is that it's a nice hard medium that people work by flaking. So they strike the stone to remove flakes. And in doing that, they change the kind of geometry of the stone. They take material gradually away. That changes both the volume of the material that's left in the surface area. The useful aspect to that process for us is that we can geometrically describe volume and surface. And the measurements that we make today, of course, reflect the geometry of the stone in the past directly. We can pretty much safely assume that the size of material that we see today was the same size that we saw in the past. It's this notion of a uniformitarian process. So we can use geometry to talk about the amount of material that should have been present, given the size of the rocks that are worked, and the amount of material that actually is present. And we can see that material has been moved away. So that gives us a quantifiable measure of movement. And we've used that a whole lot to understand how people use landscape.
When you say that it quantifies movement, the change in the geometry of the stone itself or where you find them? How is that?
The combination, actually. So one can imagine a block of stone. If you strike the block of stone, you take off a flake. If you remove that flake, then the size of the block of stone has reduced. And if you can estimate the size that originally was, the level of size change gives you a notion of how much material has been moved away. And of course, where the different material is that you find can be used to
where people have been.
Right. And that gives us a notion of movement. So we can actually quantify how much material is moving around, and from that make inferences about mobility. So that's just one example of the way that we've gone about understanding how people use a landscape.
And so now back to this idea of applying what you found in Australia with mobility to your dig in Egypt. What did you find?
I guess the interesting thing, it's a little bit like the analogy I was using about living in a home and going to work. With the development of domesticated plants and animals, people imagined, and there is indeed quite good evidence in other areas of Southwest Asia, so the Levant, for instance, that people lived in villages. So they lived in these beginning of a kind of nucleated settlement. And that's a form of settlement that perhaps strikes a chord with many of us because we live in villages, towns, cities, right? And again, we come back to this notion, well, we live in a nucleated place and we go to another place to do a set of tasks, work, for instance, right? And we can imagine that the beginnings of an animal domestication is a little bit like that, right? So people began to live in villages, and they certainly did do that in some parts of the world, but interestingly, not all parts of the world. So when we looked at the Egyptian material, what we saw was certainly the appearance of domesticated plants and animals occur, but it seems not to have such a very big effect on both overall economy, the people that from 10,000 years ago are using a lot of fish, and in fact they continue to use a lot of fish from the Nile and a big lake that is fed by the Nile, Lake Karoun, that we've been studying. And that continues even though domesticated plants and animals arrive, and they don't seem to change their movement all that much either. In fact, they don't seem to develop the sort of villages that we expect. And a lot of people have suggested, well, almost on the presence of domesticated plants and animals alone, that they must have had villages. So what we did is to look at a number of locations, large number of locations across the landscape, use some of the techniques like I described with stone artifacts to look at movement and say, well, actually, we don't find any evidence for these villages. And I think what that illustrates is that the wonderful thing about human past is the variability. We all are not the same. We have variations in the way that we engage with the environment, whether we engage with economy, and of course we engage with each other, our kind of the way that society's made up. And we really need to recognise that the wonderful variability we see around the world today is mirrored by wonderful variability in the past, and be careful that we don't fall back into that kind of stage set of revolutions that I was talking about before, to say, well, all of humanity must have gone through this sequence, because actually when we look at the past, we see all of humanity has not gone through that stage.
And some are still, for example, the landless farmers of Brazil, as an example of people who don't live in a traditional village setting.
Right.
Even today.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that's, we need to really be open to understand, almost imagine a whole set of different life ways that existed in the past, for which we can find analogues, certainly, sometimes amongst modern day peoples, but also realise that the wonderful thing about the archaeological record, that material record, it tells us about alternative ways for people to engage with the environment. And that is probably a better measure of our past than these very rigid ideas about kind of progress, right, that tend to reflect some of perhaps our own
biases,
right, our own culture rather than the culture of people in the past.
So one of the other things I found that was interesting in what you were doing was trying to see how our ancestors have dealt with changes in their climates. And first of all, I was wondering if there was some common ground there, or were they all variable as well?
Interrelationship between people, climate, and the environment is very, very interesting. And I guess it's understanding the level of engagement, because there are a couple of things. Firstly, climate change, because it's so much on the agenda, it's almost as though it kind of happened with the Industrial Revolution. And before that, the climate was absolutely uniform and never changed at all, right? And of course, when you look at paleoenvironmental studies, that's absolutely not what's happened. The environment's been shifting around at different scales and different places in a whole lot of very interesting ways. And humans throughout their evolutionary history have engaged with those environmental shifts. So we need to be quite clear that, you know, climate change is not something that just happened. Certainly the sort of climate change that's happening, the rapidity it's happening in recent times has shifted a bit. But environments have always been moving around, and it's very interesting to see the variability in the way that humans have dealt with that, right? Because we have faced environmental challenges before, and humans have found a fantastic array of ways of coping with that. So that's a major research interest for my group.
So what were some of them that you found in the different regions?
We see major shifts in North Africa, for instance, at the end of the last ice age, what we call the Pleistocene, moving into the Holocene. There's some pretty significant shifts in the nature of the Saharan regions, in the Egyptian part of the Sahara certainly, but the Sahara generally. It was considerably wetter in that period immediately after the last ice age. That lasts for quite a significant period of time, and then it begins to dry out, going closer to the hyper-arid desert that we see today. And people had to adapt to those major shifts, and they did so in a number of different ways. Pastoralism, for instance, is one technique that develops. People use domestic plants and animals. There's also a concentration, as I said, on some of these pretty rich a river like Nile or Lacustrine, the lake areas like Karoon, and they form places that people return to. And that's very interesting to see how they use those sorts of resources through time.
And then in terms of in New Zealand, could you see any of that?
Well, I guess New Zealand's a fascinating contrast to both the Australian work and the Egyptian work. Firstly, for those of you who may not know, the Polynesian settlement of New Zealand is comparatively recent compared to other areas. Australia's 40, 50,000 years or so old. Of course, the African continent saw the development from our early, very early hominin ancestors through to anatomically modern humans. Polynesia was settled much, much later. Indeed, New Zealand, 700-800 years or so of Polynesian settlement, during which Māori culture developed, right? So the indigenous people of New Zealand. So very much shorter period. But in some ways, there's some very interesting parallels. For instance, the first settlers to New Zealand faced a forested environment. It was almost uniformly forested. Little bit exception at the top of the Alps in southern New Zealand and the volcanoes in the north, but the whole area was forested. The people that came down were people who had domestic plants and some domestic animals. Not so many of the domestic animals made it to New Zealand, but certainly the domestic plants did. So they faced some issues in dealing with this fantastic new environment they'd found. Very, very rich marine resources, as there are today in New Zealand. You can imagine that in the past there would have been even more so. But coping with a different environment outside island Polynesia from where they came was a challenge. So people met that challenge in a number of different ways, established early settlements, and needed to pretty rapidly deal with the fact that they had kumaro, which is a Māori name for a sweet potato, which they needed to cultivate, which they did fast. So understanding how people interact with those early environments is important. Mobility, it turns out, is also important for New Zealand. We've got very good evidence from the sort of stone sources, the same stone artifact things again, that people were accessing a wide range of sources from all over New Zealand very early in these sites. So obviously people are moving around a great deal. So we come back to this notion, do they establish this almost European vision of a village and kind of surrounding areas, almost in a kind of medieval way? And I think that the evidence is pretty clear that they didn't. They had a, I guess, unsurprisingly, yet another take on how to deal with this new environment with domesticated plants and this fantastic marine resource. And they moved around a great deal, as we can see archaeologically.
Right. So in terms of the things that you found, I was reading one article that said that one of the pieces of evidence was dog poop. Is this something yes. that is a common type of evidence that you would analyze?
I guess it's certainly interesting, isn't it? The domestic dog is one of the animals that did make it to New Zealand. But I guess the interesting thing about archaeology is not to concentrate necessarily on single artifacts. So, you know, a lot in the movies you see the archaeologist grabbing the artifact out of some place, right? And this provides the answer to right. more or less everything, right?
But it's really a lot of puzzle pieces.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're looking at is really the mundane material that was left behind by people for a variety of reasons in different contexts. And one of the interesting things is to try and work out why material was left. Certainly, a lot of it is material that's no longer used. It's just not useful particularly. People may have reused it occasionally, but eventually it falls out of the system. Other material is perhaps lost sometimes or abandoned for a variety of different reasons. And to understand the context of the material that we find and the range of material is very important. So certainly dog poo is interesting because it tells you what the dog ate, right? One of the areas that we're very interested in researching is if we can get some paleo DNA, that's some ancient DNA, from the interior of the dog poo. Sort of somewhat bizarrely, you can think of the dog poo as a kind of capsule of material that is relatively well protected from material coming from outside. So, you know, one of the issues about getting ancient DNA is to keep it kind of protected from contamination. And the sort of DNA that we're interested in is not really so much dog DNA. We know it's from dogs, but we're interested in what the dogs ate. And we're particularly interested if the dogs ate, for instance, the sweet potato, the kumara that I mentioned, right? Because finding early evidence of that can be quite difficult. So if they consume that and we can pull that DNA out. We have not managed to achieve that yet, but it's one of our research interests, right?
You got this deep history that most of us don't have, much deeper than historians. It just goes back and back. How do you think that shapes your ideas about humanity?
For me, over the years, what's really struck me is the variability in response of different cultural people at different times in different places. Sure, there's some commonalities about the way people went around things some of the time, but it's the fascinating diversity. And, you know, there's a lot of attempts, I guess, amongst all of us to go for the big answer. Oh, it's because there's environment change or technological evolution or happenstance. And people are saying, well, that's the reason that such and such a change happened. And this explains the cultural or historical background of a particular people. And, you know, the more you study the deep past, as you point out, and in different regions, the more you realize that that one explanation really isn't going to cut it. It's the wonderful diversity of interaction between people and other people, people in the environment, people in the material culture that they developed. It's that real complexity in the context, in the historical context where we find it. That is the story of humanity, rather than this drive to explain everything by single processes.
Yeah. Now, in modernity, and that we are dealing with climate change and we are dealing with conflict, and probably some similarities as what our ancestors have dealt with, does it give you some sense of how we've evolved, or if we have really evolved, or are we seeing kind of just very minor shifts in what humanity has become?
I think it very much depends what we mean by evolution. And we can define and talk about evolution in a whole lot of different ways, biological evolution, cultural evolution, right? We can use it as a kind of pretty strict Darwinian concept. We can use it as a more general analogy. And I think perhaps the word gets bandied around a lot with those definitions merging into each other. And that's probably not the best to kind of look at. I certainly think that looking at all this diversity probably the first thing is to understand the diversity, that the way that one group acts is not necessarily the way another group acts. And to get understanding, the more people realize that there's a lot of different ways of approaching problems, and the history of approaching problems leads to a whole lot of different solutions, the better we are. Going in with this, well, the model works in my backyard, therefore it will work in somebody else's backyard, is probably not one that's sustained much by the sort of material I've looked at, right?
Simon Holdaway, great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle.
It was a pleasure.
Simon Holdaway is a professor of anthropology at the University of Auckland, where he also serves as the head of School of Social Sciences. Simon Holdaway is the author of a number of publications, including A Record in Stone, and his more recent one, Geoarchaeology in Aboriginal Landscape in Semi-Arid Australia. That's it for today's program, which you can hear again at scholarcircle.org. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. Special thanks to Artur Kaizakyan, founder of Letters from Quarantine. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week. We close with Lynn Finger reading a poem from the epicenter of quarantine.
I stand under the mesquite tree. Its frilled fronds and dripping pods have lightened into a pale gold from the bareness I saw before. The seasons change, and we are not here to see. The doves have gotten a good start on their slender twig nests. They flutter without effort on the walkway where no one walks. They land near each other where no one is near. They play there where no one else plays. They don't miss us. The air is silent. Nothing is striving. It is almost possible to believe in the stillness and peace, and that people are not dying from a virus that has taken license of the earth or is trying to. The earth moves on without us. The leaves, the doves, all move on. Even the walkway reflects the sun with no shadows. All is perfect, like a face mask discarded, no longer needed. Joy with a place to be, everything with its place to be.